I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. The consent decree between the City of Baltimore, the Baltimore Police Department, and the Department of Justice was the result of a damning report last summer that described a pattern or practice of unconstitutional misconduct by Baltimore police, which affects disproportionately communities of color. When Judge James Bredar signed the consent decree on Friday, it became an order of the court. So now, what's next? What will court oversight of the police department look like? How will the Trump Justice Department be involved with an agreement reached during the waning days of the Obama administration? And if the police department is committed to reform on its own, why is a consent decree necessary? A reporter, an activist, and two legal experts join me to explain where we go from here in reforming the Baltimore police. Midday starts right after the news. And good afternoon and welcome to Midday. Hope you had a good weekend. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Tom Hall. On January 12th of this year, after weeks of intense negotiations, the Department of Justice and the City of Baltimore announced that they had reached an agreement on a consent decree that would be enforced by the courts to compel the Baltimore City Police Department to dramatically change the way it interacted with the public, particularly in communities of color. A report by the Justice Department last summer excoriated the department for what it called a pattern or practice of conduct that, quote, violates the Constitution and federal law. The report noted that police frequently made unconstitutional stops, searches, and arrests, which disproportionately targeted African Americans. The Justice Department also said that use of excessive force by police was common, and that police often retaliated against protesters and others in violation of their constitutional rights. The announcement of the agreement on the consent decree came about a week before Donald Trump was inaugurated as president. On Inauguration Day, the Justice Department asked the court to delay a judicial hearing looking into the terms of the consent decree so that the new administration could review it. That hearing was delayed by about a week. When that hearing took place in early February, the judge overseeing the case, Judge James Bredar, sought assurances that the city, the police, and the Justice Department were committed to seeing it through, and in particular, that all the parties were committed to paying for the training and the other costs that would be involved. Having received those assurances, he took the matter under consideration. Remember that consent decrees are under the supervision of the court. So even though the city, the police department, and the Justice Department all agreed to it, it wouldn't go into effect until Judge Bredar signed it. Well, he did that last Friday morning, having denied several more requests from the Justice Department to delay the consent decree's implementation. So today we're going to talk about what this means going forward for the efforts to reform the police department and to establish trust between African Americans in Baltimore and the officers sworn to protect all of us. My guests are Monique Dixon. She's the Deputy Director of Policy for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, David Rocha, the Senior Staff Attorney at the ACLU of Maryland, and Kevin Rector, who covers the courts and crime for the Baltimore Sun. We're hoping a little later on to be joined by Gwen Brown. She's an organizer with Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development. You can join our conversation as well with your questions and comments about the consent decree. 410-662-8780 is our number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Well, welcome to you all. Thank you for being here. Kevin, let me start with you. Give us a quick sort of timeline history of what's led up to Judge Bredar's signing this consent decree a couple of days ago. Back in July, even further than that, in 2015, after the uprising and violence that coursed through the city after the death of Freddie Gray, April of 2015, then-Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake actually asked the Justice Department to intervene in some way. So give us a quick recap of what's happened since then.
So since then, the Justice Department came into Baltimore, investigated the police department. In August, released a report that found widespread unconstitutional and discriminatory policing within the city, predominantly and in particular in predominantly poor black neighborhoods. That had to do with stops and searches of individuals, corner clearing, things like that, as well as training and supervision, a wide spectrum of issues that it found within the police department. Then the city, the police department, and the Justice Department engaged in negotiations over the course of several months. Just prior to the transition to the Trump administration, they reached an agreement that went before Judge Berdar, as you mentioned. That process included then a hearing in which the judge asked both parties whether they were on board and moving forward. He asked them about some particulars within the proposed deal that he had questions about, and they talked through those. And then there was going to be a public hearing. That public hearing was set to be last week. The Justice Department, now under Jeff Sessions and the Trump administration, asked for a delay. That was denied. The hearing occurred. Most people at the hearing asked the judge for the deal to go through. And then on Friday, the judge said, "I approve it," which turns the agreement into an order of the court. So now the process moves forward. I think at this point, both parties are now engaged in finalizing the agreement under which they will move forward to try to find a federal monitor who will answer to the court and oversee the process to ensure that there is enforcement of everything that's outlined therein.
And Monique Dixon, the hearing that the judge held last Thursday, the day before he signed the order, was unusual in that it opened up to the for public comment, gave the opportunity for people from the public to discuss this order. I mean, these are not plaintiffs in the case. These are just people. You were there and you spoke at the hearing. Tell us about what happened on Thursday.
So the hearing took place at the request of Baltimore City residents. The residents have been engaged in this investigation from day one. Many of us asked the Justice Department to come in and met with the Justice Department and the Police Department and shared experiences with the Baltimore City Police Department. So when the report was released in August, right away residents began sharing what they wanted to see in the consent decree. And in fact, the Legal Defense Fund and University of Maryland School of Law and the Honorable Elijah Cummings co-hosted a public town hall where almost 300 people attended and presented to DOJ lawyers what they wanted to see in the consent decree. So both sides understood how invested community members have been in this process and therefore requested a public hearing. The judge allowed it. Last Thursday, it took place. The ceremonial courtroom was almost at capacity. 49 people testified, and most of them, the majority of the individuals who testified, asked the court to approve the consent decree. We had mothers there who shared stories of their children being killed by police. We had individuals who themselves were assaulted by police when they called for service. And so it was an opportunity for not only residents to share, you know, their experiences, but also to demonstrate to the court why the consent decree was needed at this time.
Let's hear from one of those mothers. This is Greta Carter Willis. She's one of the people who, as you say, about 49 people spoke. She's one of the folks who spoke, and she spoke to reporters following the hearing.
My message for the DOJ, you have signed this decree. We are holding you accountable. You're the ones that came in. You found these inconsistencies within this department, and you must stand to your word that you're going to allow it to go forward.
And David Rocha, the police commissioner, Kevin Davis, the mayor, Catherine Pugh, have both, from the start of this process, been very supportive of the consent decree and of the notion that the police department needs reforming. So and Kevin Davis says all the time that many of the reforms discussed in the consent decree are already underway. I mean, the processes are underway. Why do we need a consent decree? If everybody wants to reform the police department, what does the consent decree in particular do, and how does it help us accomplish the goal and would it not be accomplished absent the consent decree?
Yeah. So in many ways, the actions of the DOJ in the last, particularly in the last week, but also in the last couple weeks with the change in administration, I think provides a very clear and illustrative lesson about why we need consent decrees. So administrations change, the personalities change, priorities change, but federal judges rarely change, and court orders don't change except under a supervised process where you have to convince a judge that circumstances have changed to warrant a change. And so what is important about a consent decree is, as Kevin said, it's a court order now. And if you don't follow it, there are potential sanctions by a judge. But more importantly, there is a judge and a court-appointed monitor who is the eyes and ears of the judge, who's making sure that the judge is getting accurate, complete information, who holds the parties accountable for implementing that agreement. And, you know, there have been many promises of reform in Baltimore and elsewhere with respect to police and many other things that have gone unfulfilled. And my view is that the existence of a consent decree in Baltimore is a necessary but not sufficient condition to the kind of thorough, long-term reform that we need in the police department and policing in this city. I think it's important to say that we should not and cannot rely on the Justice Department or the court as some savior riding in, you know, the knight on shining armor riding in on their horse who's going to save all of us from ourselves. They're not. The reason that one critical reason that the mayor and the police chief were committed to this reform process and a consent decree is precisely because of the tremendous public pressure that has been exerted in Baltimore on elected officials from the top down to have reform and to have a consent decree. They weren't doing it simply out of the goodness of their hearts. Mm-hmm. There is a political reality here that has to be acknowledged, and that public pressure has to be sustained over the life of the decree, and the public needs to be involved in the decree, involved in the monitoring process. There are further reforms that need to happen with respect to some of the structural impediments that state law puts on police accountability and transparency and civilian control that still need to be changed.
So now it's been signed. This ain't over yet. And Kevin Rector, when it comes to, you know, the knight in shining armor riding in on the white horse, perhaps people had an expectation that the Obama administration and putatively a Hillary Clinton administration would be a forceful advocate for the criteria outlined in the consent decree. But now it's Jeff Sessions running DOJ and it's Donald Trump as the president of the United States. What was their argument for delaying hearings, for postponing consideration? They clearly didn't want the judge to sign this at least right away. What was the argument that they put forward as to why that would have been necessary?
Their argument, and it put Baltimore at the center of a national conversation about consent decrees, was that they needed more time to understand whether this consent decree mirrored the priorities laid out by the Trump administration for his and Jeff Sessions' Justice Department. That is to prioritize crime reduction. Sessions has said that he has, quote, grave concerns that there are provisions within the consent decree here in Baltimore that would possibly make the city less safe, that would restrict police in ways that go farther and beyond what the law restricts police from doing. The argument is an interesting one because on one hand you have the Justice Department saying, hey, we're not quite sure about everything in this deal, and you have the mayor and the police commissioner saying, we're gung-ho, let's move forward. So it raises the question as to how the deal will be implemented. That's why a consent decree is structured in the way that David mentioned. In past consent decree situations, the Justice Department has played a role in enforcing and making sure that the provisions laid out in consent decrees are applied in a given city. But if the Justice Department takes sort of a back seat in that role here in Baltimore, there will still be a federal monitor who's overseeing whether the city is complying with the deal. And that monitor will answer to the judge. So one of the things we'll be looking for at this point now is to see who that monitor is and who that monitor team will be. There's a process that's laid out in the consent decree by which both the Justice Department and the city will be able to put forward proposed monitors. The judge will ultimately decide who that monitor is. I'll be interested to see if the Justice Department proposes monitors who are particularly strong on the law enforcement side of things. And we'll see who that monitor is.
And Monique Dixon, before we go to a break, in the case of the ACA, the Trump administration, for example, has directed the IRS not to enforce the penalties that are associated with not having health insurance. So people see this as a sort of, you know, backdoor way of undermining so-called Obamacare. Does the Trump administration have the capacity in one way or the other to debilitate or to attenuate this agreement or to slow it down or to mess it up in some way, regardless of the fact that all the players involved support it and want to move forward?
Certainly. I think one example Kevin just shared, it's in the selection of the monitor. If the DOJ could recommend a monitor who is more of a law and order person as opposed to someone who is interested in protecting civilian civil rights. Another way that the Justice Department could avoid enforcing this consent decree, there is a provision in the decree that allows modification of the consent decree if both sides agree that it's necessary. And so that's another way.
So it could be amended at some point.
At some point, but of course the judge would have to approve that, which is why the Legal Defense Fund last week moved to intervene in the case because, you know, after Attorney General Sessions, who has expressed hostility toward consent decrees, even as a senator, and the Justice Department's attempt to delay the public hearing, you know, it sent a clear message to community members that the Department of Justice is trying to is not as committed to the enforcement of this consent decree. So we moved to intervene as plaintiffs on behalf of community churches for community development and an individual, Ralph Moore, asking the court to allow us to intervene to protect their right to be free from unconstitutional policing.
And so you were trying to become a plaintiff in the NAACP Legal Defense Fund.
Our clients.
On behalf of your client.
That's correct.
Ralph Moore, who's a well-known activist here in town.
Yes.
And has there been a decision on that?
So just an hour ago, the court denied our motion, but gave us the opportunity to file again if the Justice Department indeed does not enforce the consent decree.
All right. We will have more on the consent decree to reform the Baltimore City Police Department when we come back. Kevin Rector of the Baltimore Sun is here. David Rocha is the senior staff attorney for the ACLU of Maryland. Monique Dixon is with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. When we come back from a break, we hope to be in touch with Bishop Douglas Miles. He's the co-chair emeritus of BUILD, Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development, and the pastor at Koinonia Baptist Church. We'll get his take on all of this, and we will get yours as well. 410-662-8780 is our phone number, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. Stick around, we will be right back.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. Glad you're with us today. I'm Tom Hall, and it's midday. By the way, today is Sine Die, the final day of the Maryland General Assembly. So coming up tomorrow, we'll take a look at issues that the legislature took up this year that are of particular concern to children and families. And then on Wednesday, we'll take a look back at what the General Assembly did and did not do during the last 90 days. Today, Our focus is on the consent decree that Judge James Bredar signed on Friday, putting it into effect. It calls for the police department here in Baltimore to increase training, to equip officers with things like body cameras, and to improve the frazzled climate of distrust between police and communities of color here in Baltimore. My guests today are Monique Dixon. She's the Deputy Director for Policy at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. David Rocha is the Senior Staff Attorney at the ACLU of Maryland. And Kevin Rector covers the courts and crime for the Baltimore Sun. You are welcome to join us. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wipr.org and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. So I want to turn first to Bishop Douglas Miles, who joins us on the phone. He is the pastor of the Koinonia Baptist Church and a co-chair emeritus of BUILD, Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development. Bishop Miles, welcome to the program.
My joy to be with you.
And we are particularly delighted to be able to speak to you. You were going to come into the studio, and as I understand it, on your way to the studio, you were involved in a car accident. So first question is, how are you feeling?
Well, I'm feeling pretty good. I'm going to be sore, I'm sure of that, but no major injuries.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. So tell us your take on the events of last Thursday, the hearing in which 49 people testified with Judge Bredar about the consent decree, and then Friday, the judge's decision to sign it and put it into effect.
I think the level of interest in this consent decree was shown by the number of persons who showed up literally with a few days' notice to share in the hearings and to express concern about the Justice Department attempt to delay the whole process. I think what happened with the Justice Department as it currently is structured and headed by Attorney General Sessions is to be expected. It was obvious from the time that this administration came into office that they had declared themselves, and I put it in quotes, friends of the police, as if none of us are friends of the police. But we're the friends of police who operate within the law, as opposed to what I believe this administration is signaling, that even if police operate outside the law, that they will not be intricately involved in seeking prosecution.
Let's listen to a clip of Mayor Pugh reacting to the fact that the judge, as we said, signed this order on Friday, putting the consent decree into effect.
I believe that what we put together was right for Baltimore and certainly right for our police department, and that we were committed, as I said to you all the other day, of moving this consent decree forward. So I think this is a great victory for the citizens of Baltimore as well as for our police department. The next step is that we've got to put together the community oversight group, and then we'll be in the process of looking for our independent monitor. We're looking forward to that and moving forward.
And Bishop Miles, when it comes to this community oversight group, who should be on that task force? Who should be on that committee? How should those people be selected?
Of course, I think there should be significant community representation. I would hasten to say that the No Boundaries Coalition and the BUILD organization should be a part of that process. A special shout out to Gwen Brown, our organizer in Sandtown, and Joanne Stanton, one of our leaders, who processed and pursued this issue. In fact, I called them in a meeting last week in a term that I thought I'd never use, quoting Sarah Palin, that they were pit bulls in lipstick on this issue of the consent decree, and they've stuck with it, and they've led the BUILD effort in securing this consent decree and pressing forward with it. There should be broad community representation, and if that does not happen, then I think it will create some sense of credibility lack in the process.
And David Rocha from ACLU of Maryland, advocates for the police are saying that there are parts of this consent decree that tie their hands, that make doing their job on a day-to-day basis, an instance-by-instance basis, when they're actually on the street confronting people that they suspect have committed crimes, it's difficult. This is what motivates Attorney General Jeff Sessions to say this could make Baltimore a less safe place. There is this dichotomy between people who say the police need to figure out how to the city and the police need to be more concerned with the civil rights of citizens and the police saying if we are concerned with the civil rights of citizens, it makes us puts us in a difficult position to do our jobs. That's a terrible dichotomy. There is a way of being constitutional and being effective as law enforcement people, aren't there? Isn't there?
It's a false dichotomy, and it's a dichotomy that is created by an ideological and frankly fact-free hostility to consent decrees in particular, and to the process and progress of reforming policing in this country in general. I think the advocates of police reform in Baltimore live in Baltimore. And as much as anyone else in Baltimore want to be safe in their communities. And I think what advocates of police reform, and I think probably what even Commissioner Davis and Mayor Pugh recognize, is that reforming police will make us safer. You can't have a functioning police department that is fundamentally mistrusted, resented, and hostile to the community that it is supposed to serve. You simply cannot. And what you have is this, on the part of people like Jeff Sessions, this false and frankly ridiculous assertion that policing and safety equates to arrest numbers. And if life were that simple, life isn't that simple, and there is empirical refutation of that simplistic notion both here in Baltimore and around the country. In the wake of the lawsuit that we filed against the Baltimore City Police Department in 2006 and the settlement of that lawsuit, arrests dropped dramatically to less than half of what they had been when the lawsuit was filed. And yet crime also dropped precipitously during that same time. And so if arrests equals reduction in crime, what happened? Was the world suddenly spinning in reverse in all those years? They weren't. And that assertion and assumption is just to be blind to reality. But that is what really underlies Jeff Sessions and his ilk's hostility is hostility to the process of reform in general, mm-hmm. and a fundamental lack of concern for the civil rights of the people whose rights are being abused. That has to be said.
That's David Rocha of ACLU. Marilyn Monique Dixon of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund is here with us in Studio A, as is Kevin Rector, who reports on crime in the courts for the city of Baltimore. Bishop Douglas Miles, a co-chair emeritus of BILD, is on the line with us. You are welcome to join us here on Midday. 410-662-8780 is the number. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @midday. Tom Hall. So, Kevin Rector, to David's point, in 2006, arrests went down and crime went down. We are no longer in a period where crime is going down. Crime is very much on the increase here in Baltimore, although nationwide, it is decreasing. One of the crimes that apparently has been committed was committed by a very elite unit of the Baltimore City Police Department. Seven people, charged with doing very sensitive and putatively important police work were indicted for some very, very bad behavior. They have not been tried yet. They are considered innocent until proven guilty, but there's certainly a lot of evidence in terms of audio recordings and video recordings that indicate that these seven officers were doing some pretty nasty stuff. So in the context of all that, plus the spike in murders, the spike in robberies, the spike in assaults, how's that going to impact this the implementation of the consent decree?
Well, I don't know what was running through Judge Bredar's head when he approved the consent decree on Friday, but I'll say that he is also the judge on the bench in that case against those seven officers. And they're not the first officers to be charged with crimes in Baltimore. I've heard from officers about the consent decree, both in terms of the criticisms of it, that they feel that it might lead to more crime in the city. I've also heard officers say that it's going to help in terms of bringing in new technology, giving them more resources, increasing training. Certainly, Commissioner Davis speaks to that aspect of the consent decree when he talks about how it will affect crime in the city. He talks about the increased training for officers. He talks about increased supervision for officers on the ground in the city, working some of these neighborhoods with the deepest crime problems. We will have to wait and see whether and how the consent decree is implemented in ways that may correlate to crime reductions in certain neighborhoods. I know it is a big discussion at the national level, which way to look at consent decrees, how to gauge the impact on crime rates in the cities where they have been implemented. So it's something we'll be watching. Certainly, we are not in a point in Baltimore where crime is down. We're at historic homicide levels. Part of that is the responsibility of the police department. Part of that is the responsibility of the state's attorney's office. Part of that is the responsibility of the city and all of its other agencies in these neighborhoods where they are trying to implement change.
And of course, when it comes to the state's attorney's office, Marilyn Mosby, the state's attorney, has already said that she's going to have to drop a bunch of cases that involve these seven officers. So her capacity to prosecute people who may have done some, committed some crimes is going to be impeded.
And that goes to the point of advocates for consent decrees. People point to cases like the charging of the seven officers, the indictment of these seven officers. They were members of an elite gun task force. Now there are hundreds of cases that are under review in which individuals who were arrested possibly with guns, many of the cases involved guns, and these officers were doing allegedly some shady things, so maybe we shouldn't trust the facts alleged in all of those cases. But those are hundreds of cases, many of them gun cases, that may be dropped now by the state's attorney's office. And there's another another point of advocates. There are millions and millions of dollars spent each year on settlements in cases in which individuals allege that they've been abused by police. So advocates would say that there are benefits to consent decrees on the back end that allow for the police department to be more effective than they are now.
Yeah, several million dollars given just to the family of Freddie Gray. I mean, plus many other families. Let's try to sneak in a call before we take a break. Jacqueline in Baltimore, welcome to Midday, talking about the consent decree. How are you doing?
And I just wanted to make a quick comment that we're really supportive of the judge signing the consent decree. While the police department may be making changes in some of the most obvious things, the most marginalized women and LGBT people are still being targeted for sexual harassment and sexual misconduct. And the consent decree and the monitoring process will try to rein that in. And so we just wanted to make that comment.
That's indeed the case, Jacqueline. That is part of the consent decree. It has to do with how the police department investigates sexual assault cases. Monique Dixon, before we go to a break, people say that all politics is local, and people have said that, law enforcement is really a local matter, although you had a candidate, Donald Trump, saying he's going to be the law and order president. What is, in general, what is the capacity of the federal government to affect in any way how policing is done and how law enforcement is effective at the local level?
In several ways. One is through funding. So law enforcement agencies receive federal funding for law enforcement through a number of grants. And the federal government, when these agencies receive the grants, they also must sign a document stating that they will not discriminate against the residents who they serve. And the federal government is required to make sure that law enforcement agencies comply with the non-discrimination document that they sign, and also federal law, which prohibits discrimination by recipients of federal funds. So that's one way. And also through the process that we're talking about today, the attorney general has the authority under the law enforcement misconduct statute to investigate police departments that have shown to have a pattern or practice of unlawful policing. And to,
yeah, Baltimore is by no means the only one.
Right. And there's a number. And I to that point, Jeff Sessions' concern that these consent decrees are somehow undermining law enforcement and it's dangerous for law enforcement just is simply not true. Over the 23 years that law has been in place, the Department of Justice has investigated 70 law enforcement agencies, 70 out of 18,000 nationwide, and has entered into agreements with only 40. So it's, we would argue that there hasn't been enough of investigations of police departments. So, you know, we're just
at the very best, it appears they're being very cautious about
that's
it,
right,
doesn't it? Yeah.
That's right.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we will have more on the consent decree designed to reform the Baltimore Police Department. Bishop Douglas Miles joins us on the phone. He's the pastor of Koinonia Baptist Church and a co-chair emeritus of BILD. Kevin Rector of the Baltimore Sun is here in studio, along with Monique Dixon of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and David Rocha of ACLU of Maryland. By the way, looking ahead here on Midday next month, on Wednesday, May 3rd, we hope to have Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis here in Studio A to take my questions and yours. The commissioner has agreed to be on our program a couple of times in the last several weeks, but some last-minute things have come up and he's had to reschedule. So at this juncture, May 3rd is on his calendar and ours, and we look forward to the opportunity to be with him then. And today, you can be with us if you'd like. 410-662-8780 is the phone number. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle at midday Tom Hall. So before we take a break, on Mondays, it is our practice here on Midday to read the names of the people who have fallen victim to violence in our city during the previous week. We do so in sympathy to their families and friends, and our hearts ache for them. So far this year, 84 people have been killed in Baltimore. An unnamed victim that we reported last Monday has now been identified as Claude Maid, age 32, and two people were victims of a homicide in Baltimore last week. They are Lamar Chambers, age 22, and Larry Miller. He was 20 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday here on your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday here on 88.1 WYPR. If you've just joined us, we're talking today about the consent decree between the City of Baltimore, the Baltimore Police Department, and the Department of Justice. An agreement was signed in the waning days of the Obama administration late last year, and the current Justice Department, under the direction of former Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, has asked the Justice Department to review all agreements of this nature across the country, and it tried repeatedly to delay the implementation of the consent decree here in Baltimore. But on Friday, after several months and holding hearings, Judge James Bredar signed it, putting into force as an order of the court now. So the consent decree is no longer an abstraction. It is the real deal. My guests today are Monique Dixon. She's the Deputy Director of Policy for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. David Rocha is the Senior Staff Attorney at the ACLU of Maryland. Bishop Douglas Miles joins us on the phone. He's the pastor of Koinonia Baptist Church and a co-chair emeritus of BILD, Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development. And Kevin Rector is here as well. He covers the courts and crime for the Baltimore Sun. If you'd like to chime in on the consent decree, your thoughts about the Baltimore Police Department and how it can repair or perhaps some people would say begin a process in which the African-American community in Baltimore in particular has a much greater level of trust between that community and the police. Give us a call, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle at midday Tom Hall. So Bishop Miles, in the consent decree on the second page, there is a statement that says the following. It says, while the city and the Baltimore police did not and do not admit or agree with the findings in the United States report, in other words, that report that we've been talking about that came out last August, which animated the consent decree, The city and the police recognized that the federal government's findings raised issues of importance to the city. So what's the difference between recognizing the issues of importance and then they do say very forthrightly that they don't accept the findings. Are you convinced, and Gwen Brown, the organizer for Build, as she's talked to people in the community, that do people believe Kevin Davis when he says the police department is committed to reform?
I think it goes back to the old saying that Reagan used against Gorbachev, trust but verify. The police department in Baltimore City has a lot to prove to the citizens. And let me just say this. There's something fundamentally wrong in our country and in our city if correct policing cannot reduce crime. If the police are saying the only way they can reduce crime is that there's a hands-off, non-accountability, no accountability status in the community. And I think that that's what the consent decree speaks to, and I think that that's where the city officials and police department are not being truthful. For years, black politicians, white politicians, policemen have known the problems here in Baltimore with policing. For years, it was totally ignored until the cry came up from the community that forced this consent decree to take place.
And David Rocha, the issue of community input we've talked about. People have said that, you know, they've weighed in both at the hearing and in other forums that the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, No Boundaries, Build have done. If the Justice Department has the capacity to, at some point going forward, suggest amendments, does the community have the same capacity? I mean, can anybody go to the court and say, this doesn't go far enough? There are things that we need to do in addition to the things that we've already outlined. I mean, is this – what's the likelihood of that?
Not directly. The consent decree is the resolution of litigation. So the reason we have a consent decree is because after the findings letter and at the same time that the proposed consent decree was filed with the court – the Justice Department actually sued the City of Baltimore and the Baltimore City Police Department, saying, you've engaged in this pattern and practice of unconstitutional behavior. Here's the consent decree that is intended to remedy that. But the only parties before the court are the Justice Department and the city. As Monique said, the Legal Defense Fund sought to intervene. The judge today denied that motion, saying that as to the concern about the Justice Department not fully enforcing the decree, it's essentially premature, but leaving open the possibility that it will get renewed. So it may be that if the Justice Department, in ways that become public before the judge, abdicates its responsibility both under the consent decree and under the federal statute that gives the Justice Department the responsibility to intervene in police departments that are engaged in this pattern and practice of illegal conduct, then I suspect that there will be another intervention motion. But that's the only way for the public or for anyone other than the current parties to be directly before the court. But let me just add one important caveat to that, which is the monitoring process itself. So in the consent decree, specifically, this was something that we and other community advocates have pressed for from the beginning, is for the monitor to be not just hearing directly from the public, but actually using local community-based organizations as part of the monitoring process, as part of a structured interview process for getting direct community input from people who have the trust of the community, who can inform that monitoring process and be a part of it. And that's critically important. So that at the moment, that is the primary mechanism, and the public should stay involved.
Mm-hmm. Kevin Rector, does anybody have any notion of what this is going to cost? This is going to happen in the context of, for example, the school system in the city of Baltimore, looking at a $130 million deficit, some of which has been made up by state intervention, by Mayor Pugh allocating money, frankly, from the police department and to some extent to the schools, but not all of it. So there's still a problem with the Baltimore City schools in particular, and there are budget problems in our city like there are in cities across the country. Does anybody know what the price tag is, and what's your take on the mayor's optimism about being able to pay for it?
Whew.
Because she does seem pretty optimistic. She has consistently said, we'll find the money.
The mayor has said that. She has allocated $10 million in her first annual budget for consent decree costs. The governor has put aside $2 million in state funding for such costs. The police department expects to spend, I think, $7.5 million a year annually, implementing these costs over several years. The mayor has expressed some confidence that she may be able to attract either private funding or some a semblance of federal funding to help pay for some of the initiatives, although that's entirely unclear. There's no federal funding specifically attached to consent decrees. The mayor gave that reason, her ability to attract outside funding, as one of the reasons why she felt that the consent decree itself was important, because she felt that if it was in place, she would have better luck doing that. Once you look at the issue of funding the consent decree in light of the overall police budget, and particularly in light of the conversation that's been going on in Baltimore regarding the police budget versus the school's budget and the school's deficit versus police overtime and all of those things, it becomes hugely complicated. One thing that is outlined in the consent decree is that it requires the police department to conduct a review, a study of its staffing, to determine if it's right-sized, if it has its personnel in the right positions, et cetera. The city itself, the commissioner, have said that it doesn't, that there are more than 200 positions at the moment that are filled by sworn officers that should be filled by civilians and therefore cost less to the city. So whether there are mechanisms within the consent decree that bring down costs is something to be seen, and whether and how the city actually implements its own spending to pay for the consent decree, and whether the mayor can, like she said, attract outside funding is all to be seen.
So we're running out of time. Monique Dixon, I'm going to give you the last word here. There's a group called the Vera Institute. They came up with a report about this kind of thing, consent decrees around the country, and they note that use of force is actually relatively rare. It comprises about 1.6% of all encounters between police and civilians. But we've got a Justice Department here who is in some ways encouraging police departments to adopt policing strategies that were prevalent in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And here in Baltimore, we think that those kinds of strategies led to the uprising that we had 2 years ago. It seems like federal funding would be a long shot in a Sessions Department of Justice. What's your level of optimism about this actually working?
About the consent decree working?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that we have the commitment. I'm optimistic. Let's start there. We have the commitment of residents and city officials to move this consent decree forward. I am not as optimistic about the Department of Justice enforcing the consent decree, and we stand ready to intervene if it does not.
All right. We will keep an eye on it. I appreciate all of you coming in. Thank you so much. And Bishop Miles joining us on the phone. I appreciate your participation and hope you are feeling better. Thanks to everybody. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bishop Doug Miles is the co-chair emeritus of BUILD. Monique Dixon is the deputy director of policy for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. David Rocha is the senior staff attorney at ACLU of Maryland. And Kevin Rector covers the courts and crime for the Baltimore Sun. We've got links to more on the consent decree at WIPR.org/midday. Thanks to the Diz for providing lunch today for our guests. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner. They got breakfast served on the weekends on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow and Wednesday, we're going to talk about what's cooking in the General Assembly. Today is Sine Die. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. If you're celebrating Passover this week, Chag Pesach Kasher V'Sameach, which means have a kosher and happy Passover. Thanks for listening.